Welcome to Down Among the Donkeys, a podcast from the Donkey Sanctuary. In 13 episodes, we are telling the story behind the founding of one of the biggest equine charities in the world. Down Among the Donkeys by Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. Chapter 9. Work Abroad and the Greek Tragedy. The decision to help donkeys in other parts of the world resulted from the letters received concerning the appalling conditions abroad, which I couldn't ignore. A new charity had to be formed, which was the International Donkey Protection Trust, IDPT. And as Rosalind de Wesselow was interested in the work, we asked her to be one of the trustees. I also approached Colonel Norman Dodd, whom I had met previously in donkey circles, and who is a well-known journalist in the equine world. He and his wife, Eileen, are charming people and travel regularly to various parts of the globe. He agreed to help us and become a trustee. June Evers, Niels and myself made up the five trustees we felt were needed. People had been sending small amounts of money designated to be spent on donkeys abroad, and by the time we called the first meeting on the 27th of January 1976, we had funds of £250 in hand, and our application to become a registered charity had been accepted. The document signed, we decided to make an initial survey of countries to include South America, Ireland, the Middle East, Greece, North Africa, North America, Europe, Jamaica, and Turkey. Wherever possible, two trustees would travel, and once a survey had been completed, areas of work could be decided upon. Obviously, the scope of our work would have to be limited by the funds available, and I didn't really feel we could advertise a great deal until the initial survey had been done. Some of the countries were out of reach, as just the expense of getting there would have taken all our accumulated funds. However, Niels and his crew were sailing across to Cork in Southern Ireland on a big yacht race, and I had already arranged to go over to be with him. This meant that whilst there, at no cost to the charity, I would be able to have a look around and see the conditions for myself. It turned out to be quite an exciting trip. Two of the other crew's wives came with me, and there were 2 clear days before the men arrived, after their somewhat arduous sail. Pam Jermyn, a well-known member of the Donkey Breed Society, working in Southern Ireland, had a beautiful donkey stud and was keenly concerned about the welfare of Irish donkeys. She gave me an introduction to the Irish Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and a great deal of information on the problems in that part of the world. The state of donkeys' feet working in the peat bogs was bad, as was the general treatment meted out to the donkeys, many of whom were used for pulling small milk carts. There was insufficient work for our trust to spend a lot of money in Southern Ireland, I felt, and we could probably leave it to the Donkey Breed Society, already working there, and to the ISPCA to put their own house in order. The men arrived the following day, and we had 2 fabulous days before they set off on the return journey to Plymouth. Our flight home proved quite hilarious. I was wearing an emerald green suit, and with Margaret Brooke chose the front seat of the very small aeroplane that was flying us back to Plymouth. I remember there were also 4 nuns on the flight. The plane seemed to sit on the tarmac for a long time, and we could see the pilot in the cockpit just in front of us, looking round impatiently. The stewardess walked past, and I leant over and asked, "What's the matter? Have we got some problems?" She replied, "Yes, the co-pilot hasn't turned up." "I'll do it," said I jokingly, laughing at Margaret, and to our immense surprise and horror, the pilot beckoned me forward. I just couldn't believe it was happening, but he said, "Sit down and put the headphones on." And so there I sat with the headphones on, wondering what on earth to do next. He thrust a board onto my lap with a long checklist on it and said tersely, "Read those off." I read out the strange names, one after the other, while he checked them off in the cockpit. Then, with a sharp, "Right, make sure your belt's fastened," we were taxiing down the runway. Through my earphones, I could hear the familiar call-up sign for St. Morgan, and as I felt I must add some contribution, I mentioned it to the pilot. He nodded happily, and then we had taken off, and we were climbing up over Cork Airport. Once the course had been set, he leant back in his seat, and through the little microphone he spoke into, asked, "How long have you been a stewardess for Aer Lingus?" I realised then why I was sitting in the co-pilot's seat, and didn't quite know how I should break the news to him. "I'm sorry. I'm not employed by Aer Lingus," I said. His expression of dismay nearly sent me into hysterical giggles, as he realised the mistake that he had made. He was, however, extremely kind, and when I explained I did have a wireless operator's licence and held my navigation qualifications, he was a little happier. I sat in the co-pilot seat all the way back to Plymouth, and as we taxied up to the terminal, I was quite disappointed Niels wasn't there to see me coming in. I had been writing to all the countries suggested at the trustees' meeting, and found a tremendous opposition from agricultural and veterinary officials to any suggestion that we should come over from England to help. But the situation was slightly different in Greece and Turkey. We had taken on a housekeeper, Vanadia Sandon Humphreys, whom we called Noddy, to cope with the day-to-day running of the house. Noddy absolutely adored the donkeys, as well as being particularly interested in the association of donkeys and disabled children, and she helped outside when there was time and the opportunity. Her daughter's fiancé was Greek, and his mother ran a very popular television chat programme which appeared regularly in Greece. Through Noddy, I was able to arrange to present a programme about donkeys in Greece after being there for a week, and to show how the donkeys could be helped. We also had a visitor at the sanctuary one Sunday morning whose name was Bora Paran. He was Turkish and was a reporter on a popular daily newspaper there. He was fascinated by the work we were doing in England, and when I explained about the charity formed to help people with donkey problems in other countries, he told me of the thousands of donkeys in Turkey, which were an essential part of the economy and were in desperate need of help. We received a full page in the Turkish newspaper, Yeni Asir, which included beautiful photographs in colour of the donkeys in our sanctuary and the work we were doing. Bora Paran offered to help me if I went to Turkey, and to provide us with a free translator and transport, as long as the newspaper would be allowed to take pictures of me working. I contacted the World Federation for the Protection of Animals, who had representatives in Greece and Turkey, and they seemed more than willing for me to come. For a long time, Niels had been getting more and more worried at the amount of work I was doing, and he persuaded me to take what was to be a dream holiday. With Alfred and Gloria Carpenter, Norman and Margaret Brooke, and Peter and Rosie Culkin, our great friends, we decided to charter a yacht and sail round the Greek islands. After the holiday, I would stay on in Greece and do the work there, and then move on to Turkey and return home. Once again, flight costs could be shared, and it was agreed with the trustees that I would pay half, as I was going to have a holiday as well, and IDPT would only be responsible for me the day I started work in Athens. It seemed the most wonderful opportunity, and I don't think I have ever felt I needed a holiday more. After a good deal of poring over details, we had booked a 60-foot yacht named Rusalka, and it was with great excitement that we arrived in Athens and walked along the quay to see our boat for the first time. The crew of the Rusalka consisted of Chuck and M. Guest, who, purely by chance, happened to live in Sidmouth, and a deckhand called Claire. For the first 3 or 4 days, I found it very difficult to unwind. My mind was still so much on the donkeys and the problems I had left behind that I found myself looking anxiously for donkeys as we came into each small harbour on the holiday. Those that we did see on the islands were extremely well looked after, and although they were carrying loads which seemed very heavy, the locals were being kind to them, and there was no real need for concern. It was on the island of Paros that my first problems arose. We went ashore for a quick drink and saw 3 mules waiting to take a load up to the village 3 miles away. Niels got into conversation with a man who was loading the mules and in error said that I was a donkey doctor. He immediately dropped everything and pulled me by the hand to look at the second mule, who was lame. I thought it was quite probable the mule had something in its hoof, and Chuck, who was with us, went back to the boat to get my medical bag. I had taken the precaution before leaving England of making up a bag, with the vet's help, of what I thought I might need as a sort of first aid for donkeys. It contained a special ointment called Demobian, which was a great healer, an aerosol spray of terramycin for wounds and infections, a hoof pick, and a surgical kit with local anaesthetic in case I came across any severe cases and had to stitch an animal up. Chuck brought the case back and I got out my hoof pick. It was the first time I had ever had dealings with the back legs of a mule, and the first thing I noticed was the alacrity with which the owner went and held the head. After 6 unsuccessful attempts to pick out the hoof, which kept flashing past my right ear, I gave up. The job was completely impossible. By this time, it appeared that almost all the inhabitants of Paros had arrived and were standing around us in a large wide circle. Niels and the crew from Rusalka were looking equally concerned, and it was going to be very difficult to retrieve what had now become a matter of national pride. I tried to look unconcerned and asked Chuck to pass me the terramycin can. There was a deadly silence as I held the can approximately a foot away from the mule's hind foot. There was quite obviously a swelling there, and it appeared very likely that it had an infection of the fetlock. Aiming at the main swelling, I pressed the spray and a jet of purple terramycin hit exactly the right place. By the time the mule realised that medication had been administered and kicked out again, it was too late. The treatment had been given. You could almost feel the air of relief amongst the crew and the awe of the crowd. The owner rushed up to me and thanked me most sincerely, and after our drink, we got back on the boat feeling pleased with the success of my first donkey mission. We stayed the night in the bay off Paros, and the following morning I was treated with great respect wherever I went and was able to look at a lot of mules and donkeys on the island. None seemed over the age of about 12 years old, and all seemed in reasonably good condition. The value of a mule on Paros appeared to be approximately £500, so no wonder they took such great care of them. The next day, we sailed to Santorini, a volcanic island. We anchored at the foot of the steep cliff, on the top of which lies the village. The only way from the quay up to the village is by an almost vertical winding track, and a large number of mules and donkeys were standing at the bottom with saddles on, ready to transport visitors up and down. At the time of our arrival, ours was the only boat there, and I wandered off to have a good look at the condition of the animals. There were a number of caves around, and we went into some of these and found adequate supplies of alfalfa grass, which had been dried for the mules to eat. I tried to persuade one of the owners to take a saddle off the mule, but this he was reluctant to do, and we soon discovered why. On our way up to the village, we saw a large liner arriving, which anchored just off the quay, and within 20 minutes some 200 or 300 tourists were clattering past us on the mules on their journey to the top. I was surprised to see that the mules seemed to enjoy the gallop up the long hill, and even those without a rider would canter up alongside those giving rides. Once they got to the top, the drover just gave one shout and the whole lot turned round and thundered back down to the bottom again. We loved the village of Santorini and spent almost the whole day going round the little shops. For the first time on the holiday, I felt really relaxed and well. It was a beautiful hot day and we were all beginning to get very sunburnt and fit. Early in the evening, we took our little boat and went across to see the volcano which lies just off Santorini. You can anchor your boat at the bottom of the volcano and climb right up onto the rim and into the crater itself. The smell of sulphur was almost overwhelming, and it was quite frightening at times to feel the bottom of one's shoes getting extremely hot. I was very glad to return to Rusalka. Em and Chuck had invited us for a drink at the tiny taverna which was situated on the quay, and it was almost pitch dark as we left Rusalka and found our way down the gangplank. There were one or two lights on the quay and taverna, and as we made our way across we heard a strange clinking noise. One of the small donkeys that had been going up and down the quay all day was wandering around with a large chain round its neck. We could see it had some sores on its back, and I told the others to have a drink whilst I just slipped back and got my medical bag to treat it. The bag was in my cabin and my mind was on nothing but the donkey as I made my way back to it. The aft hatch over the aft set of berths had been opened up wide for ventilation, and in the dark the black space appeared as a hatch cover. In my haste I walked straight into it. I remember trying to grab hold of the hatch as I fell 12 feet to the deck below, but I was unable to hold on. Violent pain seared through my body, and I lay partially winded and in such agony I was unable even to call out. Em was busy cooking the dinner and heard the thud of my fall. I heard her come forward saying, "Has somebody dropped something? Is something the matter?" And then she saw me. It was a great relief to know somebody knew I was there, but I was unable to say anything to her at all as her anxious face came close to mine, and I heard her saying, "My God, Betty, are you all right?" She vanished for a moment and then reappeared with a blanket which she put over me, and then I heard her going up onto the deck and running down the gangplank towards the taverna. I believe it was only a few moments before Niels was kneeling by me, but it felt much longer. I found I was able to speak again and gingerly began to move each limb in turn to see what I had done. My left leg wouldn't move at all, but my right leg seemed all right, as did my left arm. But when Niels tried to lift me to move me onto a bunk, the most excruciating pains shot through the upper half of my body and my left leg. I tried not to make too much noise as he put me into a more comfortable position, and then sat by me holding my hand, tears slowly dropping down his face. "Darling, what have you done?" he asked. "Just when you were beginning to have a holiday, why has this had to happen?" And then Chuck's anxious face was leaning over Niels. "I will go and get a doctor," he said. "There must be a doctor somewhere in the village." Poor Chuck, he had to run all that way up to the town and eventually returned with the village doctor. Fortunately, he spoke some English, and without moving me, he examined my leg and chest. "I don't think she has done much damage," he said, "but I really think perhaps you ought to take her to hospital and have some x-rays. It is just possible she has broken something." Everybody looked round in dismay. Where was the nearest hospital? The nearest island with medical facilities is Syros, which is 90 miles away, he continued. They have a municipal hospital, and there is usually one doctor on duty. I suggest you set off as soon as you can, and I will give her an injection which will take the pain away during the journey. He gave me an injection and left the boat. I could hear everyone in the dining room discussing what was to be done next, and within 10 minutes we were underway. It was decided not to use the sails as this would put the boat at an angle, which would be difficult for me. And so, with the engines at full steam ahead, we set off for Cirrus. It was an absolutely nightmare journey. The injection he had given me seemed to do nothing at all, and I could neither move nor breathe without extreme pain. My left leg was beginning to swell at an alarming rate, and I now found enormous bruising appearing down the inside of my right arm. All through the night, our friends kept popping in to see how I was doing, and Niels never left my side. Eventually Niels said, "Only a few minutes, darling, and we will be in." And in the dawn we arrived at Cirrus. Chuck organised things very quickly, and within an hour Niels came down to tell me that the ambulance had arrived to take me. And then the real problem started: how to get me off the boat. The doors were not wide enough for a stretcher to be carried through, and in the end it was found the only way to get me out was the same way as I had fallen in, through the hatch. Once again, they were unable to do this on a stretcher, and I had to be lifted by my arms and pulled up through the hold by the ambulance men. I was almost unconscious as I was put on the stretcher and carried into the ambulance. We arrived at the hospital, and I still have no idea of what it looked like, as I never saw more than the ceilings. I was wheeled into a large corridor where there were a large number of peasants milling around. They were all fascinated by my condition, and my trolley was constantly pushed and knocked as people tried to get a better position to see what had happened. Eventually the doctor arrived, and having a quick look, he started shouting in rapid Greek. After that, events moved very fast. I was wheeled into an X-ray room, which reminded me of the very first pictures of X-ray equipment ever developed in the world. The machines were high and old-fashioned, and each time they were going to take a picture, the men pushed a button and then ran for a little door which they slammed as they went through, and then immediately reappeared through another door. If I hadn't been in such terrible pain, I would really have found it rather funny. But under the circumstances, I didn't feel like laughing. After the X-rays, I was pushed back into the corridor, and a heated discussion in Greek took place. I think one of the worst parts of an accident abroad is not being able to understand what people are saying, and the doctor seemed to be getting more and more anxious as he held up the 5 X-rays which had been taken. He showed these to everybody who wanted to look, including the crowd of locals, which had now grown to quite enormous size. "Please," said Niels loudly, "can somebody tell me what's the matter? Can my wife go back, or has she to stay in?" One of the nurses spoke a little English. She put her hand on Niels' arm. "Your wife will stay a long time," she said slowly. "She has broken 5 of her ribs, and it is possible the liver is ruptured. A piece of rib has broken away, and could make it worse. It is very dangerous. The doctor says if your wife moves, she dies. Please tell her." With sinking heart, I had heard the conversation, and the doctor was now speaking rapidly to the nurse, who was able to translate for us. I was wheeled through a very large ward and thankfully into a small private room at the end. Being lifted into bed was agony, and I was terrified to move in view of the diagnosis. A nurse appeared with a large rubber bag, and this was put over my liver. It was full of ice and extremely uncomfortable. Nobody made any attempt to put any strapping around the broken bones, or even bothered to look at my left leg, which seemed equally painful to me. Another nurse arrived with a large metal tray and the most enormous syringe I have seen for many years. It was the old metal type with a huge steel needle. What injections they gave me, I still don't know. But I got them every 4 hours, and eventually my backside resembled the map I had made many years earlier to show where our Modec dryers were distributed throughout the length and breadth of England. They moved a camp bed in for Niels, and bless him, He stayed with me night and day. The crew sent a beautiful bunch of roses up, and then regretfully had to set sail, as they were due to be back in Athens 6 days later for the end of the holiday. The next 4 days were indescribable. I was in constant pain, day and night, and nobody seemed to be able to do anything at all for me, except to replace the ice bag every 4 hours. Eating was almost impossible, as every time I even lifted my head, the nurses told me the only English they had been taught for the occasion, "You move, you die." They provided a straw, and I drank a little greasy soup through it, but apart from that, nothing else was possible. Niels got paler and paler, and eventually he began to feel very sickly. We were convinced it was the terrible conditions. The hygiene of the hospital was almost zero. Every morning the woman that cleaned the room with a filthy, dirty mopping bucket would clean the communal toilet first. Horrible brown smears would be left all over our floor when she went out. The needles that were used for injections appeared to have been used many times before they were re-sterilized, and if I happened to be the unlucky one to be treated after the municipal ward, then it was a very painful injection indeed. By the 4th day, we were both nearly ready to give up. Then fate stepped in once again. Purely by chance, a doctor from one of the big Athens hospitals, who was on holiday, called in at the hospital. He took one look at me and said to Niels, "You must get your wife out of here immediately and into one of the hospitals in Athens. There is no doubt that if she doesn't have proper treatment, she is going to die. If her liver does rupture here, they have no facilities for operating and there is no way her life can be saved." We were both extremely frightened by his comments, as we realized that they were probably very true. Niels rushed out to try to see the doctor, but he refused to see Niels, and the nurse, who spoke a little English, said, "He is not happy that the other doctor has seen your wife, and he says she must not be moved or else she will die." Niels came back to me and said, "Who can we contact in Athens? Do you know anybody who might help?" I suddenly thought of Ellie Evangelidou, the lady who was going to do the television interview with me in Greece. I had her telephone number amongst my papers, and Niels rushed out to a phone box bearing this. I lay helplessly whilst he was away, concerned not only for myself, but for Niels, who still seemed to feel constantly sick. He was back in an hour with a smile on his face for the first time. "Darling, she was marvellous," he said. "She knows the director of the Cat Hospital in Athens, which is apparently one of the best hospitals, and it has its own helicopter pad. So if I can arrange a helicopter and get you there immediately, she will have arranged it at that end." He rushed out again and within an hour was back. "I have arranged for a helicopter tomorrow morning at 10:30, he said. "It's going to cost £500, but we will just have to pay it. I've got to get you out of here." We spent a very bad night. I was used to being awake all night, but Niels had eaten something that disagreed with him, and he was uncomfortable with stomach ache for most of the time. The nurse, who spoke a little English and had been given a special attention, slipped in and gave him some tablets, which seemed to help the situation. But we were both grateful when the morning came, and Niels could make arrangements to get me out. The doctor was extremely annoyed we were leaving and tried to hold us up as I was carried out to the private ambulance Niels had hired. "You will die," were his last words to me as I left the hospital. Not the most encouraging start to what was to be a very difficult journey to Athens. We were getting very concerned over time, as the helicopter pilot had said he could only wait 5 minutes, having landed, and each minute over that would cost us an extra £10. We arrived down at the quay, and there was the helicopter waiting. Niels had brought a large blanket to carry me on, as the hospital was unwilling to lend us even a stretcher for the journey. They lifted me up in the blanket, and hundreds of willing peasant hands managed to touch me on the short transfer between the ambulance and the front seat of the helicopter. One seat had been removed in the tiny aircraft, so I could lie flat, and Niels crouched beside me, his knees almost up to his chin, with the suitcase propped on top as we took off and made the journey to Athens. It was our first trip in a helicopter, and I was very aware that it could easily be my last trip in anything. The pain was still intense, and the doctor's words rang in my ears the whole time, "You move, you die." However, we landed safely and a luxurious ambulance pulled right by the helicopter to take me the 200 yards to the entrance of the hospital. I was put on a stretcher and once again wheeled along a long white corridor. Niels completely vanished at this time and I began to panic slightly. I had moved a lot and I was still alive. I intended to stay that way and tried to attract attention as best I could. "Help," I said hopelessly. "I've lost my husband. Can somebody help me?" Eventually, a very kindly looking doctor bent down and asked, "Are you English?" I was so relieved to find somebody speaking our language that I burst into tears, and this seemed to do the trick, for within seconds I was wheeled into one of the consultants' rooms. The last job my favourite nurse had done was to put another ice bag over my liver to last during the journey, and Dr. Vranas, the specialist, who was now looking after me, viewed it with horror as the blanket covers were removed. "Whatever is this?" he asked. I explained that as my liver was punctured, they had kept ice over the liver ever since the accident. "How many days?" he asked tersely. "It is 5 days now," I replied. He grabbed the bag and threw it off. "My God, you will be frozen. Your kidneys will have stopped working," he mumbled. "Why ever have they done this thing?" "Sit up," he said abruptly. I lay gazing up at him. "But I can't," I said. "If I move, I die." "That was yesterday," said Dr. Vranas. "You are here now. You don't die. Sit up." And so, for the first time in 5 days, I was able to try moving my position. The joy of just being able to move without dying was overwhelming, and despite the excruciating pain, I managed to raise my shoulders off the pillows. "Well done," said Dr. Vranas. "Okay, now we start your treatment. You must go straight to X-ray and we will see how the ribs are getting on. Then we must look at this leg of yours and we will put you in a nice room and feed you up a little bit. I don't expect you have eaten much lately." His kind face was almost too much for me, and at that moment Niels came into the consulting room, having at long last traced me. He looked pale and drawn. "Is she going to be all right?" he asked anxiously. "Your wife will be fine," said Dr. Vranas. "She just needs plenty of time to rest and recover, some good food and just a little bit of treatment." He smiled at us both. "She is a good friend of Eli Evangelidou, and we will see she gets everything she needs." He smiled and left the room. The feeling of relief was indescribable. I wasn't going to die after all. We were taken through miles and miles of corridors and a large modern lift and into the most super room overlooking Athens. It had its own private sitting room and bathroom. I was unable to get used to the luxury after the Syros hospital. Above my bed was a special framework so I could pull myself into a more upright position, as it was impossible with my broken ribs for me to raise myself unaided. Once again, they kindly placed a camp bed for Niels in the corner. Niels was not looking at all well. "I wonder if I should tell the doctor about my stomach pains," he said, as we settled into our superb new room. "Why don't you?" I said. "He will be coming round to see me this evening." And Niels agreed to do this. At first, Dr. Vranas thought it was rather a joke, Niels feeling ill as well, but he did make him lie down and have a quick feel round his stomach. "I think we will have another look at this again in the morning. Don't worry. Both get a good night's sleep, and I'm sure you will both soon feel better." Niels was able to make a call home to the children and the hotel that evening to tell them that at long last I was on the road to recovery and to give them our new telephone number. I was still on a drip as I was unable to eat properly, but for the first time I was given a small piece of goat's cheese for breakfast, which was a definite improvement on the revolting food on Syros. Niels was not feeling a bit well, and when Dr. Vranas came to see him at 8, he sent him straight off down to have an X-ray. I was beginning to get extremely concerned. Niels never complained and had always been completely fit, but he looked so grey and drawn and was feeling so sickly that it just couldn't be purely worry about me. Within 5 minutes of Niels leaving the room, to my horror, a large trolley was pushed in by two men wearing green gowns and masks. I was convinced they had come for me and was horrified that Niels wasn't there. Had my liver burst? I lay worrying myself silly, but suddenly realized that the men had no interest in me at all. 5 minutes later, the door opened and Niels was pushed in on a wheelchair. Without even letting him get off the wheelchair, they bent forward, lifted him up, put him on the trolley, and vanished from the room. You can imagine my feelings. I rang the bell frantically, but nobody came, and when eventually a nurse did arrive, she couldn't speak any English. "Dr. Vranus," I insisted firmly. "Dr. Vranus." It was the only name I knew, but she only smiled and shook her head and went out of the door. For 2.5 hours, I lay there waiting for somebody to tell me what was happening and getting more and more desperately anxious as Niels didn't return. Then suddenly the door burst open and 4 nurses came in, wheeling a bed similar to my own. Without speaking, they next pushed me nearer the window and put the second bed into place. All the bedclothes were stripped off it and a rubber sheet laid on, with a single white sheet across it. There was no pillow. Drip stands were brought in and set up next to the bed, and I could only lie in horror, trying to think what was happening. 1/4 hour later, the door was pushed wide open again, and in came a trolley. There were 2 nurses at either side of Niels, both holding drips high above him, and Niels was completely unconscious. The men lifted him onto the bed. The nurses fitted the drips to the 2 drip stands by the bed, and then everybody left. I lay looking across at Niels, tears pouring down my face. Whatever had happened to him? My poor Niels. Fortunately, at that moment, Dr. Vranus walked in. I hardly recognized him in his green operating gown, but he came straight across and sat down on my bed, taking the mask away from his face as he did so. He held my hand and said, "I'm sorry, dear. You really do seem to have got problems between you. Your husband's appendix burst some time last night, and by the time he was X-rayed, he already had acute peritonitis. We have done our best, but there is still some danger for the next few hours. Don't worry, we will do everything we can for you both." Neil's first words when he became conscious some hours later were typical. "Did they really need to do it? I never get ill." But alas, this time he really had. The following morning at 6 o'clock, I looked across to Niels and saw his eyes were wide open. "Do you know, darling," he said seriously, "before they would accept you into this hospital, I had to guarantee £1,000 and pay every single drachma I had on me to the registrar, and now I am ill too. I do hope our insurance is going to cover all this." "I don't mind," I said feelingly, "as long as we get out of here alive." Niels, of course, has an extremely strong constitution, but I am pleased to say that I managed to get out of bed before he did. I had to ring England and tell them that it was now Niels on the danger list, not myself, and I could just imagine the concern my phone call must have aroused at home. The hospital was absolutely wonderful. I had been lying thinking miserably in Syros. Why on earth did this happen to me when I was only trying to help animals? It did all seem so unfair, but now the reason had been made clear. As Dr. Vranus had said, had Niels not been in hospital when his appendix burst, then he would have died. We found later that the Rusalka became stormbound on her journey home to Athens. At the very time Niels' appendix burst, she was sheltering from the gale in the lee of an uninhabited island almost 200 miles from the nearest port. On the last day of our stay in hospital, Ellie Evangelidou came to see me with the secretary of the Hellenic Animal Welfare Society, Patricia Stethatos. They were so concerned to see our condition, which had caused considerable interest amongst all the staff and patients in the Cat Hospital. They promised me full cooperation and the chance of a broadcast the following year if I would come back to Greece, and this I promised to do. Arrangements for the journey home proved very difficult. The hospital was very good and rang British Airways, and they came to our bedside to arrange tickets and travel arrangements. It meant two stretchers, two wheelchairs, two special seats, and similar arrangements to meet us at London Airport. Our bank at Ottery St. Mary cabled out £1,500, which was our bill from the hospital. And almost 6 weeks after leaving England for our holiday of a lifetime, we were both laid out in the first-class compartment of a British Airways plane. Never had we been so pleased to see British Airways in all our life, and they treated us most royally. We were both given a free half bottle of champagne, and the pilot came to talk to us after takeoff. Having seen the intense pain that the ascent had caused me, he arranged with London Airport for a long approach to prevent any further discomfort for me. Niels had a large Citroën estate car, and Peter Feather, my nephew, who was managing the hotel, was waiting to meet us from the ambulance at London Airport. He had made the back of the car into a bed, and Niels and I laid together side by side on the long journey back to Devon. We did get one good laugh when Peter had to fill up with petrol, and the startled petrol attendant suddenly became aware of Niels and me lying in the bed at the back. Seeing his startled expression, Peter explained quietly, "Well, you see, they are on honeymoon. I am only the chauffeur. This is the way they wanted it." And he got back into the car and drove off. After this expedition, I decided not to go on the return trip to Greece and Turkey on my own, and so June Evers, my friend and trustee, came with me the following year, in March 1977. Pat Stethatos was kindness itself, and after a 5-day tour of Greece, I was able to see many of the cruelty problems for myself. These were indeed intense. On the mainland, the attitude to the donkeys was very different to that of the peasants on the islands. We saw the most terrible sights, including donkeys with their eyes poked out by sticks, and the most savage beatings which even my medications could not ease. We worked very hard whilst over there, and the television programme proved a tremendous success. Through interpreters, I was able to explain how much more the donkeys could help the peasants if they were treated better, and I appealed for less weight to be put on the donkeys' backs. Very few vets are concerned about the care of donkeys in other countries, as the owner of a donkey generally cannot afford to pay for a vet. They seemed quite surprised that anybody would take particular interest in them, looking on them purely as a beast of burden. The situation in Turkey was slightly better, whereas on the Greek islands the value of the animal to the economy was recognised, and while some were in desperate trouble, it was only fair to say that the children of the peasants suffered equally. I think the donkeys got as much food as the rest of the family. Our help here was so greatly appreciated that we realised the use of our charity. The peasants were desperate for medications, and once they learnt we had come into the village, they would queue outside almost all night so that we could treat their animals in the morning before moving on. We spent 9 days in Turkey and decided we must return there the following year. Our next mission was to North Africa and the Middle East, and we linked up here with two charities already working in these areas, the Society for the Protection of Animals in North Africa, SPANA, which covers Tunisia, Libya and Algeria, and with Brook Hospital in Cairo, which tackles Egypt. We met a tremendous number of donkeys and an equivalent number of donkey problems. Apart from treating donkeys and mules, SPANA look after dogs, cats and other animals, and they seemed particularly interested that a charity should concentrate just on donkeys and mules. Once again, on aging all the animals, I found very few aged over 14 or 15, and began to wonder if there was any specific reason for this. It was quite possible it was the overloading, although this certainly wasn't so in every case I saw, as donkeys were doing many different jobs, such as turning water wheels, being used for driving carts and for ploughing. I wondered if it could possibly be too many parasites in the gut, and answers to my many questions seemed to point to this factor. Many donkeys seemed to die with severe pains in the stomach, which the vets put down to colic. I began to think this could be a large dose of worms, which eventually ruptured the gut. The cooperation from Spanner was magnificent, and we arranged to visit them the following year to follow up our work and to help with their program to exchange the cruel bits which are used on the donkeys. We had taken 24 bits over with us, and these were used within our first 2 days' work. We would start work at 6 a.m. when it was cool, and by 12 o'clock in the morning we would sometimes have treated over 200 donkeys in the various souks. Conditions were extremely poor, and by the time we went on to Egypt, neither of us was feeling particularly well. The Egyptian part of the tour proved similarly difficult. The Brook Hospital proved a real oasis for animals in the middle of Cairo, and the cases of deliberate cruelty we saw in this part of the world were heartbreaking. We found not only animals suffering this fate, but also children who were still being sold into private households as servants at the age of 5 and contracted to these people until they married. We went out with the Brook Hospital and worked with them in the souks, where our terramycin spray and Dermobian cream were in frequent use and relieved the suffering of many poor mules and donkeys. By the third day in Egypt, we were both becoming very ill. The fleas which affected us did not come from the donkeys, but from the many people that pressed around us the whole time we were working. I would finish treating an ulcerated sore on a donkey's chest and find I was physically unable to stand up properly because of the people all around me. They were often crawling with fleas, and these would drop on our arms, hair, and legs as we worked. We were staying in cheap hotels to save money for the charity, and 9 out of 10 of these did not possess proper washing facilities. We frequently had only a tap and a bucket of cold water, and this economy on the hotels proved very false. June's legs began to swell as the bites went septic, and we both had some form of dysentery. What a relief it was to return to England 3 days before the tour was due to end. I was raising funds for our work through appeals in the newsletter which I was now writing, and the following year we arranged to visit the isolated parts of Turkey we had previously visited, where the donkeys were having such trouble. A cheap way of visiting was to use the boat Small World, which carried 24 passengers and spent 1 or 2 days at many small ports along the west and south coasts. We decided to set up a worm dosing program and purchase collars for the donkeys we were going to treat. I was now convinced that the reason for the early death of the donkeys was the parasite infestation. We took a small laboratory, which we set up in our cabin on Small World and which included a microscope through which we could examine the dung samples. The Turkish newspaper, Yeni Asir, had already produced another double-page colour feature on the work to be done and had set out an itinerary of where we were going to land so that peasants could bring their donkeys down to the quaysides. Despite our preparations and investigations before the trip started, it proved an absolute disaster. We landed at the small ports where the donkeys had been in profusion the year before to find no donkeys at all. We found the odd one and took dung samples from it and treated it with the anthelmintic we had carried to prevent worms, duly examining the samples back in the cabin. It was very difficult working with a microscope, as either the boat was moving or, when in port, the generators were on, causing a certain amount of quiver and making analysis of the samples very difficult. However, we persevered, and amongst the few animals we were able to test, we found a tremendous incidence of both eggs and live larvae. By the time the boat had reached Antalya, its furthest port, east, we were almost desperate with worry. We had only treated 23 donkeys, and we knew we were wasting our hard-earned funds. All along the coast in the boat, we had kept noticing numerous polythene-sheeted greenhouses which had not been there the year before. Were these anything to do with our problem? In Antalya, we went to the local agricultural office, where we met the veterinary surgeon for the area. He refused to believe that all the donkeys had vanished. He produced hundreds of figures which showed that there were donkeys everywhere, and eventually we tied him down to one area called Kass, approximately 200 kilometres along the coast, and where we knew our boat would be calling at the end of its tour. We made our way with great difficulty overland. It was a 24-hour journey, as it was frequently broken by long waits at the roadside for mountain roads which had subsided to be re-levelled. We finally arrived, exhausted, in Kass, having carried all our laboratory equipment and our medical gear with us, and managed to find a very small boarding house where we had a clean, bare room with two beds, and a tap in the side of the wall with a bucket, which was to be our only washing facilities. We both lay on our beds, and I was almost dropping off to sleep when a terrible yell from June caused me to sit bolt upright. "Help, Betty, look over your head," she cried. And there was the biggest spider I had ever seen. He must have been as big as my hand and was firmly ensconced in the corner. "As long as that stays in this room, I am not staying," said June, and she vanished through the door. I undid my belt, and by standing on the bed and flicking the spider with the end, was able to drive him to the wall over the open doorway. And eventually, to my great relief, he crawled under the lintel and out into the corridor. June returned in as dignified a manner as possible, and once again we collapsed on our beds. It was to be a short-lived rest, however, and it could only have been 10 minutes before the mosquitoes and flies began to make their presence felt. Gradually the room began to fill, and all thought of rest driven from our minds as we desperately sprayed fly killer from my medical pack. By evening the situation was untenable, and with grim determination and June's full permission, I searched the corridor until I found our unwelcome spider and gradually reintroduced it to our bedroom. We all lived happily together with no flies for the rest of our stay. You can imagine our disappointment in Kass to find that instead of 1,870 donkeys promised by the agricultural officer, there were exactly 3. I don't think 3 donkeys have ever been more thoroughly examined, and once again, the dung samples tested were full of all types of parasites. We were pleased to see the boat call in on our last day. That morning, June had narrowly missed putting her foot into her shoe, in which a scorpion had been sleeping. It really wasn't one of our best trips, and it was good to be back in England. On our return, thinking of the many greenhouses and tomatoes being grown, I rang Heinz in London to see if they could be connected in any way. They told me they had been trying to help the economy of poor areas by encouraging the peasants to set up greenhouses for growing tomatoes, and were deeply concerned that their help had in some way affected the welfare of the donkeys. In June 1979, we returned to North Africa to work with Spanner, and it has proved our most successful trip. With the complete cooperation of Spanner, we dosed over 1,000 donkeys in the area, and we worked night and day in our laboratory, examining samples and keeping very careful records of each donkey treated. In addition to the worming doses, we dealt with innumerable saddle sores and wounds and were able to help the valuable work done by Spanner in this area. We set up a proper research program using 12 donkeys which had a complete medical examination, took samples which were fully analysed. Spanner will administer the treatment which we started every 2 months until we return to check the health of these particular 12 donkeys. We hope to prove that we can not only extend the donkey's life by anything up to 10 years, but that we can make it a much fitter and healthier life. A great deal of the suffering of these poor donkeys in all parts of the world is caused by their lack of nourishment and the small amount they do receive having to be shared by a myriad of parasites to which they are host. Our most exciting trip has been to South America in November 1979, the direct result of a bequest. I think the report published by Bob Forbes, our publicity officer and BBC freelance journalist, sums it up very well. Mercy mission to South America. The donkeys of South America are in fine fettle. That is the general conclusion reached by animal lover Betty Svensson following a 15,000-mile fact-finding mission. From oil-rich Venezuela, where petrol is 10p a gallon, to the arid wastes of Peru and the green Andean valleys in Ecuador, she found that the South American values his working donkey. Mrs. Svensson, who runs a donkey sanctuary at Salcombe Regis near Sidmouth, headed a team of four. Others were Mr. Andrew Trawford, the sanctuary's vet, Miss June Evers, a trustee, and Mr. Bob Forbes, journalist and broadcaster, who returned this weekend after a month-long trip. The project was financed by a legacy left specifically for the expedition by a Miss Cook's Trust. Mrs. Svensson, who founded the International Donkey Protection Trust, says in her report, "At the end of the tour to South America, I feel a strange mixture of pride and humility. I am proud of the way the donkey helps humanity in this part of the world, a gentle, patient beast of burden, never complaining, often working almost completely alone, carrying enormous loads from the fields to his owner's house. Pride in that his near-starving owner treats him with care and often affection and to the best of his ability. And humble in that people in such near or starving conditions can retain their pride, keep themselves so clean and be so dignified in their appalling state. I have been so lucky to have such a good team on this trip, which at best has been hard, at times almost disastrous. In our search for the truth regarding donkeys and their conditions in this vast continent, we have had to leave the main highways and tourist areas, and have literally taken to the hills. Maps have proved inaccurate, and even the best navigations have found us on impassable roads, in temperatures up to 100 degrees, with hired cars which tended to break down at regular intervals. Add to this the attentions of strange biting insects, accommodation not always of acceptable standard, and the sort of food we had to live on, and it is clear why teamwork has been vitally important to the overall success of the trip. We have seen over 1,000 donkeys since leaving the UK, and with a few notable exceptions, have treated everyone in need. In Venezuela, we found large herds of feral donkeys living a completely natural existence. These we were unable to get near, but this country we found rich and advanced, and the donkey almost extinct as a working animal. In Peru and Ecuador, however, the picture was extremely different, and the donkey an important part of every village and hill community. The more inaccessible a village, the more necessary the donkey. Our help was received with gratitude once the people were assured our help was Libra, free, and the donkeys were brought to us from all parts of the village. We treated some ulcerous sores, many rope burns from tethering, and almost all for parasites. Generally, in Peru, the donkeys, cattle, sheep and goat were kept in a communal compound, so our work was made easy. But in Ecuador, in the villages where we worked, 10,000 feet up in the mountains, each little shack had its donkey in the yard. The owners were mainly Indians, and their care of the donkeys good. Unlike our work in other parts of the world, there were no terrible mouth wounds. None of the donkeys wore bits in their mouths, and they are proved here to be totally unnecessary. A tremendous amount of suffering to donkeys could be saved in other parts of the world by emulating their example. The fact that we found no old donkeys could be for two reasons, either as in other parts of the world they die due to parasites, or, as we were told to be the fact in northern and southern Ecuador, but were unable to confirm personally, they are slaughtered at the age of 10 to 12 years to provide much-needed food for a starving population. In either event, I feel the donkeys in this part of the world have a much more cared-for life than their brothers in Africa and the Middle East. The films made in South America by June Evers, provided and developed by the BBC, got nationwide showing. The great interest of the public resulted in a financial gain for the charity. The next trip for IDBT is to be an exploratory trip to southern Spain by Rosalind de Wesselo and Pat Feather, following up the many cases of reported cruelty. If, on their week's tour, they find the donkeys in real need, their trip is to be followed by one encompassing a fully equipped medical team. June Evers and I are due to return to the North African deserts with our laboratory and a BBC film crew to follow up our past 2 years' work and to examine the 12 donkeys treated with our anthelmintics every 8 weeks since our last visit. The reports received from El Haj M. Abdurrahman Ledri, the senior Spana vet, are highly encouraging, with a significant improvement in the condition of the 12 treated donkeys. We are looking forward to seeing them. If this improvement is the case, then a very practical way to help the starving of the third world would be for governments to provide free anthelmintics for donkeys and mules so that they can live healthier, longer lives to the general benefit of the starving peasants who rely on them.